This is the Side Hustle Show with Nick Loper, episode 11.
Welcome to the Side Hustle Show, where aspiring part-time entrepreneurs learn how to turn their side hustle dreams into reality. Because your 9-to-5 may make you a living, but your 5-to-9 makes you alive. And now, your host, Nick Loper.
Hey everybody, Nick Loper here. Welcome to the Side Hustle Show. This is episode 11, and my guest is Jason Plimmel, the founder of MockDraftCentral.com, a membership site dedicated to helping fantasy sports players have more success in their leagues. Now, I wanted to have Jason on because his story is really inspiring about how good things happen when you can build a business around something you care about and something other people care about, even if it's in an ultra competitive area like sports going up against big name players like ESPN. So I also love this business because it started as a side hustle, and the membership revenue model brings money in month after month. So even though the startup costs in this case were quite high, I think there's still some great takeaways for side hustlers looking to build a web app or software product of their own. So we will cover how it all got started, growing the user base, including a pretty innovative tactic there, and eventually selling the company and cashing out. And with that, let's get right into it. Jason, good morning. Welcome to the Side Hustle Show.
Good morning, Nick.
So let's take me back in time. This is probably close to 10 years ago. You're working as a full-time IT consultant, and tell me about the creation of this Mock Draft Central website. Where did the idea come from? How did you build this up?
Sure. So at the time, this was about 2001 approximately, and I had a software development company that I was running, doing software development projects for everything from insurance companies to furniture manufacturers to small startups, and it kind of got that itch to start something different, something more than just building, doing hourly work for people. And so, looking at how do I develop a product, we actually took some wrong turns initially. We developed a e-commerce package right about the same time everybody decided to make an e-commerce package. There was open source packages coming out, and so that was one of just bad timing. You know, we missed the window on that one. We also developed software for running auctions for nonprofits, and this is where life lesson learned. I didn't do enough customer validation up front. We built the software to then find out that every nonprofit tells you we can't pay for it, but if you let us use it for free, we'll tell the next people how great it is and they'll pay you.
Okay.
So that's kind of a failed model. So that quickly ran its course. And so the nexus for the idea for Mock Draft Central came from, you know, my own experience of playing fantasy sports. I realized how much time and effort I put into preparing for drafts and trying to anticipate what the other people in the league would do. I mean, it was a 16-person league, and so it was a very scarce player pool, and we really were trying to kind of outthink each other. And so I was creating scenarios in Excel and doing all this stuff, and it was really laborious, and I liked the overall outcome of it. It wasn't fun. Okay. And so I came up with a concept of, boy, if I could anonymously draft against people and just see what plays out, that would really be useful and also kind of an enjoyable thing. So in 2001, I got the domain name from MockDraftCentral.com and really went to town on starting to build it. I took one of my developers, he was a junior developer, but really skilled. And so I couldn't bill him at that high of a rate, but I could bill at a high rate.
Okay.
And so I was able to bill enough to cover his cost, and I assigned him over to start developing that version one of Mock Draft Central.
Okay, kind of take him off the client-facing software development projects and put him on this little side project.
Exactly. And so I ramped up, you know, my billable hours to cover him and to keep my mortgage paid, which is, it's always a challenge when you're trying to build something new, is to keep the mortgage paid and keep the food flowing in.
Yeah, definitely. So I think this is a great example of finding pain points from personal experience. I was reading something, you know, from the standpoint of business idea generation. It's like, well, just look back to the last weekend and write down everything you did on the weekend, and you know, you'll find what hopefully you find the things that you like to do. And if any of those things were frustrating, you know, maybe there's a business opportunity there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the one step further is to go validate that and make sure other people also think the same way, that it's not unique to you. Because I've seen people invent things that solved a problem for them, but didn't really translate more broadly to a big enough market. But if you can do that, and that makes it more inclined to be a business you're going to be interested in. I look back and I realize how much I lucked out, because running a business for 8.5 years, you know, you better like it, because you wake up every day and you do it. And I did Mock Draft Central part-time until, gosh, probably around late 2004, early 2005, when I raised investor money. And then I went full-time into it. But it was part-time for quite a while, and then it was full-time for a long while. And so that was definitely, you know, it had to be something that I look forward to every morning, and I did.
So this was something, so you had the technical chops to build it yourself, but it was something that you kind of assigned your team member to do. What was the kind of cost to complete, and how long did it take before it was up and running?
So there was two major versions that we rolled out. The original one, which in retrospect looked like every other 1999 website or 2000 website when it was, you know, all frames, goodness. that we probably invested, gosh, probably $40,000 to $50,000 in that one of pure cost. My time probably being grossly undervalued in that. And then the second go-around, where we actually really leapfrogged the industry, that was more significant. That was probably in the $250,000 to $300,000 price tag range. But we outsourced a lot of stuff at that point to accelerate, both to accelerate how quick we could do it, and also because we didn't, when we went with our version 2, it was Flash-based, and I didn't have the Flash skill set to actually develop in that. So that was a big outsourced cost.
When you guys were building this, were there other competitors? I guess maybe we should back up and kind of, can you give the quick rundown of what the premise, like what does the site do for customers?
Yeah, absolutely. So our focus was on the drafting aspect, specifically online drafting of fantasy sports teams. And so for anybody who's not familiar with fantasy sports, you get into a room or on a conference call or online with, you know, 11 of your closest friends, and you pick all these different players off NFL teams and you create your own team. So there can only be one team with, you know, Brett Favre, one team with, you know, certainly all these different running backs. And I'm dating myself by saying Brett Favre, which is hilarious. but that's the concept of it. And so we took it and made it an online experience. The focus of our subscriber site was on mock drafting, practicing, and see, you know, anticipating how is this going to go. But the functional aspects of it were no different than running your actual real draft that you were going to run the whole year with for your team.
Okay. And people would pay you for this privilege?
They would, and which was interesting because there were very quickly some free options. In fact, when we launched, there was already a free, very rudimentary option that didn't have very good technology, but it got a lot of traction. And so it was interesting. I actually had someone in the industry who told me, well, there's people won't pay for that. You're never going to make money at that. And that we proved them wrong by a lot. So that was pretty cool. That was actually a neat motivator for me, because nothing like being told you can't do something, especially to someone competitive.
I was going to say, some of these leagues have some pretty serious money on the line. So if there's a small investment up front to give yourself a better chance of winning, like maybe that's a worthwhile for some of the fantasy players.
Oh, for sure. And that was where our bread and butter ended up being, was in people who were playing it really seriously, playing either high stakes leagues or just really competitive people who But we also discovered, and this is something I didn't know going in, I looked at it in a very pragmatic sense of I want to be prepared, but it was really fun and people engaged. And it was one of these great things because people like to talk about football. They like to talk about baseball. And so what else are you going to do in a January evening and it's snowing outside and you're practice drafting and you're debating with other people in that draft room about why this player is better than that player? Our drafts would end and people would stay on and continue chatting for sometimes 45 minutes to an hour afterward. It was so cool. I never anticipated that. And yet I would log in, you know, when you're early on and you only have like that handful of customers, you log in and you figure out what's going on. And it's really amazing. You see people engaged and loving what you have.
Yeah. That's awesome to see that kind of engagement. Now I have a question, like, why was ESPN not doing this? Was Yahoo Sports not doing this? Like,
they had the technology to do drafts, but they didn't anticipate mock drafts. They didn't see people doing them and not actually running the leagues. So they had the technology, and back then it was, you know, very Java applet driven, and so the experience was okay. It was, you know, it was pretty rudimentary. It just worked, and we leapfrogged them and we went with the Flash interface.
Okay.
And just had more functionality in that. We actually won the industry award for best drafting software 2 years in a row.
Cool.
The first, I can't remember which year is which, but one year we beat ESPN, the other year we beat CBS Sports for having the best drafting software, which is a nice kudo.
Yeah, definitely.
That was pretty cool.
I had no idea there were such industry awards. That's awesome.
There's a Fantasy Sports Trade Association. I was actually a board member for a couple years.
Wow.
And co-treasurer and all that. So, yeah, it was really, really neat to see an industry where you had some really huge players, the ESPNs, Yahoo, CBS Sports, and then a lot of small startups and then, you know, established startups that had grown into really nice businesses in you know, basically niche-dominated areas. So that was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, so I think that's a really cool point about going up against some very deep-pocketed competitors and, you know, finding a niche that they were ignoring and eating their lunch.
Yeah, and it's about out-innovating them and finding out what customers want. What I discovered very quickly is that those large companies are very reactionary. When you come out with something new, they don't jump on it. They don't jump on it until their customers say, why don't you guys have this? Why don't you offer this feature? Why can't you guys do this? And then,
right.
Then they eventually copy it. But we usually had a 2 year running room, sometimes less. But the other interesting part is that it wasn't a core focus for these other companies. I mean, they had their fantasy game. Games were broad. They were all about the whole experience. We focused on the draft, so we had that niche piece of it down. But on top of that, you know, take for ESPN, for instance, they didn't have software developers dedicated to their fantasy games. They had to share them with all of ESPN.com.
Yeah.
And so they were balancing that whole aspect. And so it was easy for us to stay nimble and quick. And plus, we listen to our customers, whereas for them, they have so many customers, it's just noise to them.
True. Okay, so you're 40 or 50 grand invested in, say, half a year into this,
mm-hmm.
and you've got the first version of the site up. Now, what steps do you take to get this in front of fantasy players and customers?
So this is where I don't think we did a very good job initially. I was very much from the service side of the world, and I assumed that my experience running a service business would translate pretty easily, and it's actually a lot trickier than I thought, and it's been reinforced by my current job, which is doing business consulting for tech companies. I see it a lot of times that the mentality of selling a product is very different than the mentality of selling a service. And some people can make the jump and some people struggle with it a lot. I struggle with it quite a bit. And so I think in retrospect, I would have rolled it out differently. I would have rolled it out more broadly, faster, and would have tried to leverage partners more quickly. The way we did it was very organic. It was through search engine optimization and through just contacting people we know and having them forward it around.
Okay.
A lot of word of mouth and a lot of that. So I mean, you could get away with that back in 2002. It was a fairly Wild West, you know, industry.
Okay.
And now I think it would be hard to break into that without actually being much more strategic about how you go after getting a critical mass. And that was a big part of our business challenge, was that this site and this concept was only fun if lots of people were doing it. If you show up and there's no one to compete against, no one to practice with, it's not fun. And so that was very chicken egg kind of a challenge. Is how do you get to a critical mass? And so later on, we developed a lot of relationships with high stakes games and high stakes, you know, fantasy contests, and gave free accounts to a lot of their subscribers in the first year to get a critical mass of really high caliber people on our site. And that really drove a lot of our success going forward.
Okay. Okay. So kind of using that freebie, sign up as the customer acquisition cost.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And continuously upselling. That became our mode of operation, is that we had free, and free was a limited offering of, you could only use it a limited amount, and you could only access most of the features. But I would say 95% of new features we rolled out every year were targeting the premium, the people who are willing to pay. And so we just continually would keep putting out new premium features, and then over a year or two, we would trickle those down to free.
Okay.
And do it that way. And our conversion to pay from free initially was around 5%, which is pretty average from at least the numbers I was looking at back then, to where we got it up to around 8%, which I was thrilled with. I mean, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that seems pretty high. You think of all like the other companies that run a freemium model, it's probably 99% are stuck on the free version.
Mm-hmm. You know, pricing is always a struggle. People don't know, well, how do I price my product? What do I price it at? The answer is, take a stab and see what the market will bear. We started at $2.99, so $2.99 for a monthly subscription, and eventually, or you know, incrementally made it $3.99, then $4.99. And we tried $5.99, but found that the pushback was pretty high on $5.99.
Okay, so, okay.
For monthly, we stayed at $4.99. And then that $4.99 monthly cost drove our seasonal, which was kind of like a three-month subscription, and our annual subscription. We just multiplied it out and gave a discount that was okay. Like getting 1 or 2 months free. And that kind of worked out pretty well.
Perfect. So, okay, so now the site's up and running, you've got a critical mass of users, and you're still doing the software development thing full-time, you said, for a couple years during this time frame. Like, how much time is it taking, you know, are you spending on maintenance and marketing and everything related to the site?
Sure. In terms of dollars, it was mostly spent on maintenance and continued development. I mean, I looked at our to-do list, and it was an endless supply of to-dos. And we just kept hacking away at it. One of the big mental shifts I had to make was that, coming from a developer mentality, the answer is always, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we can do that. And so when customers would ask for things, they would ask for, hey, can it do this? Hey, can it do that? You know, it was so easy to say, yeah, we can do that, because you're making the customer happy and we could do it. Well, you do that enough and you quickly realize you've invested a lot of time and money in stuff that may not have any applicability to 90% of your customers or 95% of your customers.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I took an ROI-based approach on, is this feature going to pay for itself in 6 months or less? Because either people are signing up more, or because it's driving more traffic or getting more people on the site, that, you know, we couldn't justify doing it. And so it might stay on the list, but it would trickle to the bottom. And we had several features that we never implemented. They just kind of stayed on the to-do list for years because we couldn't figure out how to monetize them. And we couldn't figure out how to make them worth the time it took to do them.
Okay, I really like the 6 month rule. I'm going to call it the 6 month rule for ROI for new features.
That was a big deal for us. That was a huge mental shift for me, and it really turned things around a lot. It helped me prioritize as a business owner, not as a technical person.
Yeah, you get this a lot from the 37 Signals school of thought and the Lean Startup. Like you don't need all these fancy bells and whistles. Like, let's focus on, you know, on what's making money.
Absolutely.
So there comes to a point where, like, what kind of cash flow is the site generating now, to a point where you are comfortable jumping off and doing it full time?
So that was a tricky thing. What happened was Flash 5 came out, and when Flash 5 came out, I had been wanting to develop a true live draft, very interactive interface and back end. And, you know, we played around with Java applets and just really didn't like the performance of them and the experience of them. And so we just kept building more like platform infrastructure. And then when Flash 5 came out and had real programming language behind it, instead of it being more of a designer tool, and it became a true programming language, we just took the plunge. I started funding development on that through an outsourced company. We actually use Atomic Object, who is they're a fantastic firm out of Grand Rapids, okay. And they do work internationally as well. They're really excellent. And so we started funding that ourselves. I quickly realized that I couldn't fund it myself, and it, you know, not at the pace I needed to. And so I started pursuing angel investment at that point. And we were still in the super early stages, but we had customers, we had some revenue, but we were doing in the realm of, like, oh gosh, call it like 20 grand a year. I mean, it was minuscule, but enough to prove that there was demand.
Okay.
And so I talked to some individual investors, and ultimately one of them was going to make an offer. It looked like actually a giant headache. And so we ended up not doing that because they wanted to take the business a direction that didn't actually make sense. And so we went with Grand Angels, which is an angel investment group out of Grand Rapids. And that was a really good experience. They brought a lot to the table in terms of the board members that I was given to be on my board. They really helped me to make that transition to real business owner. Because I thought I was a business owner running a service company, but I really was more of a glorified self-employed person and didn't realize it. Okay. And when they were pushing me hard on, you know, the financial side of the business and how to report to a board meeting and how to keep them up to date and involve them, I realized that I wasn't as good as I thought at delegating and at decision-making and even at prioritizing my own time. You know, you'd mentioned my ability to develop software, and that was an interesting double-edged sword because it was great to a point, and it also was great because I could validate employees, I could validate consulting firms and make sure that I wasn't overpaying or make sure I knew, you know, basically they're not blowing smoke. But the flip side is that it's your comfort zone, and so it's so easy to jump into code when you should be doing other things. I had one of my board members who finally said, no, you make all your sales phone calls first. You make all of your advertising calls first. And that literally turned our business. It went from being, you know, headed toward break even to headed toward profitable because of that. And okay. So I credit him a ton with turning me into a business owner from a tech dabbler business owner.
Right. It's kind of getting, you know, from working in your business to working on it. I think that's a very important transition to make. Okay. So we'll fast forward a few years. And so these guys have infused some capital to make this new Flash version a reality. And you know, we'll kind of skip ahead a little bit to the point where now this business is attractive for somebody looking to buy it. Mm-hmm. And eventually, in what year did you sell it?
We sold it. We closed on it in 2010 in January. We initially decided to put it on the market in the fall, probably about September, August or September of 2009. And So what we did is we kind of stepped back, we being myself and my board members, looked at it and said, where are we most likely to get the best offers? And it appeared that it was most clearly going to be in the fantasy industry, because there was a lot of consolidation happening, and also there was a lot of synergies there. I should mention that our revenue stream evolved over time. So we started out with a subscription-driven business, and where we ended up over time was about 60% of our revenue was still subscriptions, 30% was advertising, and then 10% was software licensing. So we licensed our technology to other companies and labeled it for them.
Okay, cool.
And that was an evolution of our revenue streams. And so what was interesting about that is when it came time to sell, we had a lot of different value propositions to different companies. I approached 12 different industry companies. Four of them ultimately made offers.
Oh, wow.
And it was interesting because they all valued us differently. You know, that's a question I get asked a lot by my clients in my business consulting practice now, is how did they value you? It was all different. One of us valued us, you know, kind of on a typical EBITDA multiple. Another one was some hybrid of some different things. And then one was specifically looking at our users. We had 130,000 subscribers, and they were going to pay us X dollars per subscriber. And because we had the holy grail, we had the people who will pay. You know, it's easy to find people who will give you the email address and they're free and they don't really engage. There's a lot of value to a significant pile of customers that are engaged and loyal and will pay. And then another of the companies was primarily looking at us for the software. They wanted to leverage the software in their business, and they weren't even going to run the site as we were running it. Likewise, with the one that was interested in our customers, they would have most likely shut the business down, taken the customers, and just gone with that. So it's a really interesting thing when you have technology, when you have users, and when you have cash flow, you can get valued all kinds of different ways. And if you don't have that, well, you're basically as good as your technology. You're as good as your customer acquisition.
So which one did you end up going with? I'm curious, which of those methods came out the highest?
So we went with Rotosports, and they're actually running the business as is. It worked well for them. As I mentioned, like we were an advertising driven, a big part of our revenue was advertising driven. Our traffic was really heavily pre-season, and so a typical fantasy company, their traffic is a lot more in season. And so we actually, when you overlaid our traffic with theirs, it actually smoothed out their traffic over the months, because advertisers tend to like smooth, high traffic, not spiky traffic.
There was ad networks
we couldn't get into, because while we exceeded by quite a bit their minimum requirements for, you know, our good months, our bad months, we didn't, and they didn't want that.
So I guess we'll wrap things up. I wanted to ask you touched on it a little bit, but if you had to start over, like what would be kind of the first things you would do, like in that first week, that first month of, say, everything broke and you had to rebuild?
You know, I don't know that I would change a whole lot in the first month. What I would do is I would go to market a lot faster. I held off way too long on rolling stuff out. I didn't take nearly the lean startup approach that I would now. I definitely would get customer feedback much quicker. That was something that we learned over time, of how to gauge customer feedback and figure out before we build something if there was demand for it. That was a big one, is just to get things out there quicker. One of the big transitions for me from the service to the product world is, when you're a service provider and you're good at it, you trust yourself. You don't second guess things. But when you roll a product out, you have all kinds of weird emotions about, are people going to like this? And I put my soul and heart and everything into this. And what if people reject it? What does that say about me? What does it mean? And there was days where I just kind of stared at my computer, and all of a sudden it went from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock at night. And I'm like, I don't know what I did. I just kind of zoned out.
Yeah, did I get anything done today?
Yeah, and it took me a while to say, screw it, I just got to get this thing out there. We're going to miss our football opening. Because I was fortunate in that I had seasonal windows to hit. If I didn't have that, I'm not sure I would have rolled it out for another 2 months.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
The fear of missing a season drove me, as I said, screw it, I have to get it out. And that was the best thing I did, because then you start to get feedback and you find out what people do and don't like. I am really a big advocate of getting stuff out there and getting feedback, because otherwise what you do is you build what you think is perfect, and two things happen. One, you burn your whole budget up, and then you can't pivot or react. And two, you get emotionally invested in it. When you think you've refined it to a perfect thing, and then people say, but it'd be better if it did this. you're so like emotionally invested in that perfect picture that you just spend all your time trying to tell your customer why they're wrong instead of saying, oh, that makes sense. Cool, we can do that.
Yeah, that's great.
So yeah, that's a big one.
That's great. And finally, I'm going to put you on your spot for your number one tip for side hustle entrepreneurs.
Dedicate time to it. It's so easy to have your full-time thing and then you just try to generally squeeze in your part-time thing here and there, and you think you'll have time for it, and you don't. You have to set aside set times and set minimum amounts of time you're willing to put in to it every week. And that's the only way it'll happen, because it has to happen now. Otherwise, it ends up being those dreams that sits on the shelf. And it's better to do it and get out there and make it happen than it is to have this dream that you think one day will something will happen. That's a regret factor. And I see a lot of clients that don't pull the trigger on stuff. They just live with a regret. And it's much better to go try it and validate it and make it happen.
I love that. We end, kind of sign off almost every show with get out there and make something happen. So that's perfect.
Fantastic.
Jason, thanks so much for coming on and sharing all of your experience with this super cool business. Check it out. It's still not under his ownership anymore, but at mockdraftcentral.com. And if people want to learn more about you anywhere else, they should come and find you online.
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot, but LinkedIn, they can reach out to me. I'm pretty open. So,
all right,
thanks.
Very good.
I appreciate you having me on.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Sounds good. Thanks.
I love it. What do you guys think? Do you play fantasy football, by the way? I was just looking this up. More than 25 million people do, making it part of a billion-dollar industry. And so I played once or twice, but it ended up being just kind of my donation to the league. I was pretty terrible at it. So I probably could have used a service like Mock Draft Central to help me out. So curious if you guys play and if you have better success at it than I did. Anyways, thank you so much for listening. Honored you would spend part of your day with me. And if you have any questions or feedback, feel free to leave a comment at sidehustlenation.com/episode11 or send me a quick note. It's nick@sidehustlenation.com. Until next time, like Jason says, go out there and make something happen. And I will see you next week in episode 12.
Thanks for listening to The Side Hustle Show at www.sidehustlenation.com.